Geneva 1 ended up with a statement signed by the US and Russia saying that, I'm not quoting, but the solution to the Syrian conflict should be the establishment of a transitional body, including members of the regime, but not Assad, not the Assad family, but members of the regime, and members of the opposition, and that this transitional body should be given full prerogatives to lead the country throughout a political transition. Geneva II has failed for a quite simple reason, and I'm sorry if I sound biased here, but I really do think it's the reality. It's because basically the Assad regime doesn't want to hear about a political transition in Syria. The opposition said, we're okay with Geneva 1, we're okay to be part, I mean the political opposition, we're okay to be part of that transitional body with members of the regime. The countries that support the opposition have said, we're okay with that too. But the Syrian regime has said, you know, we don't want to hear about power sharing, we don't want to hear about a political transition in Syria. As you maybe know, what the Syrian regime is preparing at the moment is the re-election of Bashar al-Assad, which will be actually a no-contest election, where he'll be basically the only candidate. Because what they have in mind, of course, is to keep Assad in power. And I think if we speak of a political solution, this transitional body was the only reasonable compromise on the table. And I think that this transitional body was a reasonable compromise, and especially because it would allow for a gradual transition rather than brutal overnight change with all the dangers associated with it. And so that would lead to the transformation of the political system from an exclusive political system, you know, where basically all power is in the hand of the Assad clan, to something more inclusive. But the regime has refused it, and that's basically why a negotiation stopped. I think there were maybe many lessons from the failure of the Geneva talks earlier this year, but I will just highlight two of them here. One is, in my view, an illustration of the fact that the core of the problem in Syria is domestic. So you often hear that about, you know, the war in Syria being a proxy war between regional powers. You know, of course, regional powers are involved, as we know, Iran on the side of Assad, Gulf states and Turkey on the side of the rebels. That is true. But in my view, all of these people have been attracted into what is essentially a domestic conflict. It's a conflict about power sharing inside Syria. And what's the problem? We have this ruling clan, the Assad family, their cousins, their cronies, who are opposed to any kind of deal that would sideline them. Even if that deal keeps elements of the regime in place, as you know, the Geneva 1 statement provided for. The Assad clan is exploiting, as you may know, the fears of the Alawi community, so that's this religious minority, probably less than 10% of the population, but the Assad family belongs to it, and I would say the power holders in the military and security service in Syria belong to them. So the regime is exploiting the fears of this community towards the perceived dangers of a takeover by the Sunni-dominated opposition. Dangers ranging from the loss of relative privileges to sectarian revenge and killing. I'm not saying that these prospects are fantasies, okay? Especially after 3 years of a very bloody, brutal civil war, sectarian polarization. But the thing is that the political transition, as it was designed in Geneva 1, was probably the only safe way out for the Alawites, because it was a gradual controlled transition rather than a brutal collapse of the regime. And it's precisely the kind of gradual transition the Assad clan doesn't want to hear about. I don't think that Syria is essentially a proxy war. It has become one, because I think the Syrian conflict is a kind of black hole that's attracting everything around it in the region. And it's important to bear that in mind, because You know, the argument about the Syrian conflict being essentially a kind of foreign conflict imposed upon Syrians by foreign agendas, which I think is wrong. That leads to believe that in order to solve the conflict, you should just convince these regional powers to, you know, find an agreement among themselves, and then things would be okay. I think this is absolutely wrong. Because as long as you don't fix that problem of power sharing inside Syria, major imbalance in the distribution of power among sects, you will always have a conflict that will attract foreign players inside the country. And unfortunately, I would say that the domestic conflict is probably far more intractable than the regional power struggle. For the time being, the regime is quite confident that it will survive. So why would it abandon power through negotiations when it can keep it by using force? I don't think anyone has answered that question in a convincing way. Well, one reason may be pressures from its allies, from Russia and Iran, but I don't think this is a realistic prospect, because there is a plan B. If, you know, I said the situation is relatively good for the regime, if it deteriorates in the future, there is a plan B, which is simply to establish a state on the coast of Syria. It would be an Alawite-dominated state, because that's where most Alawites live. It's on the Syrian coast. Assad would remain the president of something, rather than ending up in a jail in the Netherlands, as would probably happen if he was to leave power. And Iran and Russia, I think, have become so closely associated with the regime, you know, by providing it with massive military support, that they would be necessarily marginalized in any post-Assad political system. I think great majority of the population is deeply hostile to Russia and Iran for their role in the conflict. So I think any elected regime in Syria would be very anti-Russian and Iranian, and would not therefore guarantee Russian and Iranian interests in Syria. And sometimes you hear, well, let's convince Russia and Iran to give up, to abandon Assad by guaranteeing the persistence of their interest in Syria. I think this is deeply problematic. First, because the idea that you can guarantee other states' influence in another state by a treaty is something we've fortunately stopped doing after the colonial era. And who would guarantee the survival of Russian and Iranian interest in Syria? Western powers don't have that power. I mean, it's very simply, they're not involved enough in the country to claim they can guarantee the survival of Russian and Iranian interest in Syria. I mean, they don't have troops on the ground, and they have very little influence on the opposition itself. Also, I think Iran and Russia would be very happy with dividing Syria. Okay, if they feel they will lose most of the country, they will happy to keep at least one part of it which is loyal to them. And as we know, that is becoming a tradition in Russian foreign policy. When Russia is losing a country, or when a country is getting out of the Russian sphere of influence, they carve themselves out some mini states in which they can retain influence. That's what they're doing now in Crimea. They did it in Moldavia 20 years ago. They did it in Georgia more recently, and so on. We hear several things from Iranian officials. Our parliamentaries who visit Tehran meet very polite Iranian diplomats who claim that they're in favor, I mean, they're not necessarily attached to the survival of Assad, that they want Syria to remain united, non-sectarian, and so on. I don't know if it's sincere or not, but the problem is that these people have absolutely nothing to say about the way Iran defines its Syrian policy. I mean, the policy of Iran in Syria is designed by the Pazarans, the guardians of the revolution. And the position of the Pazarans is very clear. They want Assad to remain in power. No military victory by the opposition is to be expected in the foreseeable future, because the regime is pushing back. And anyway, and that's something we hear in Western circles, we don't really want a military victory by the opposition, because there are very powerful radical Islamic groups among the opposition. So why not repartize with Assad? It's not only about talks, it's something that's happening. Some intelligence operatives from European governments are paying visits, you know, to Damascus now to discuss about counter-terrorism. It's immoral. I don't think I need to insist about it. It's basically a policy that consists in rewarding what is one of the most largest, most brutal and systematic campaign of mass murder in the post-Cold War era. We're speaking of a regime that has Navi Pillay, United Nations High Commissioner on Human Rights, recently said that the regime is responsible for most human rights violations that include the death of dozens of thousands of civilians, chemical attacks, summary executions on an industrial scale, starvation of entire neighborhoods, indiscriminate bombings, and all of that. It's unrealistic because believing that Assad can win and retake control of Syria and restore stability is, I think, completely misguided. Assad is actually, at the moment, consolidating his control over the center of the country, which he identifies as a very strategic zone. But he's also suffering setbacks in other regions, in the north, in the south, even on the coast. And I don't think he will ever be able to reconquer the whole territory simply because he lacks manpower. He doesn't have enough loyal soldiers to reconquer and police the entire national territory. And I will conclude by saying that seeking to repair ties with Assad is counterproductive because he cannot deliver stability. As I say, he lacks manpower, which means that when he retakes a region, what he does is first to starve people, bomb them from the air, very often force people out, which is why you have this largest refugee crisis in modern history. It's because the whole strategy is based on emptying entire regions from the population. And then lack of manpower also entails relying very heavily on foreign troops recruited by Iran among Shia militias in Lebanon and Iraq. This is definitely, it's a recipe for long-term instability because it leads to a situation where regime victories lead to foreign occupation by people who are, you know, not Syrians and do not even have the same religion as the majority of Syrian people. So, I mean, that's definitely a recipe for long-term instability. And even if you think, and some people apparently think they can fight Islamic extremism by allying with Assad, which I think is profoundly misguided too. It's like believing you can fight fire with the help of a pyroman. Assad has a terrible record. I mean, he supported and manipulated jihadi groups in Iraq after 2003, in Lebanon a bit later in the decade. After the uprising started in 2011, he deliberately encouraged the emergence of jihadi groups by releasing dozens of radical Islamic activists from jail. I mean, the more we learn about the individual profile of insurgent leaders, the more we realize that dozens of them, like very hardline Islamists, were deliberately released by the regime in the spring of 2011. But I think he needs Islamic radicals to survive. Because for a simple reason, if they weren't part of the conflict, you know, on the side of the opposition, no one would look at him in the West as a potential partner. Okay, he would be looked at for what he is, which is a mass murderer.